the show.
Hey everyone, this is Lisa Anderson. Welcome to this week's show. I'm going to give you a little scoop on what you're going to be hearing coming up. For our inbox later on in the show, Dr. Greg Smalley is here to address a question from a woman who's getting married for the first time to a guy for whom it's his second marriage. So she has reservations about that. Just what does she need to know? What about her own fears in that situation? He is certainly the one to address that. So we're excited he's here. Then also for our culture segment, another awesome expert, Dr. Dan Allender, is here. He is the author of Healing the Wounded Heart. We're going to have a very frank discussion with him on the ramifications of sexual abuse. And so he has experienced sexual abuse. He's a victim of it, as well as having counseled for years and years and years, many people who walk through this struggle. So I hope we will all gain encouragement and direction from that. Well, since this is just our difficult subject show, I guess, we're going to actually talk about, I have three women here in the studio alongside me to talk about the issue kind of, because we're going to talk a little bit about like submission, okay, biblical submission, but more in the context. I don't want anyone to think here that I'm going to sit here and give some like theological treatise on it. Other people can do that better than I can. This is one of those when the rubber hits the road and you are sitting around either talking with your girlfriend or you are dating a guy or you are hoping to get married but wondering if you can even do it because you feel like you just are too strong or too whatever. What does this actually look like, practically applied, especially when, and both genders do this, kind of the blame game of like, well, if women weren't so crazy and catty, we wouldn't have all these problems. And if men weren't so passive and lame, we wouldn't have all these problems. And it's very easy for us to go in both directions. So very excited to welcome Ashley, Chrysinthia, and Kate to the table. Hey, ladies.
Hey.
Very good to have you here. Okay, well, I want to first put the spotlight on Ashley and Kate because they are friends and they basically came to the Boundless Show with this idea because clearly they wrestle with it. So I think we just need to put them out there as an example. But no, tell us a little bit about how you guys kind of got into this conversation and where it was going.
Yeah, so Kate is actually my neighbor, and we met randomly on the sidewalk one day, and we decided to have coffee, and before we knew it, we were talking about what does it mean to submit, and I'm single, and Kate's recently married, and so kind of looking at what that looks like from our different stages of life, and I've heard a lot of people who are single and around my age talking about how they're sort of afraid to get married because of the idea of biblical submission, and what does that mean, and does that mean suddenly that you don't have your identity anymore, and you're suddenly like repressed, and you can't follow God's calling on your own life? Or how do you, what does it look like to submit to someone? And Kate started sharing with me from her perspective, so I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I think before I was married, I just had a lot of reservations in that area and what submission looked like and things like that. And of course, I wanted to be submissive because I was following Jesus and I just wanted to.
Always a good start.
I wanted to follow what the word said, but I was just kind of like, just like what Ashley was saying, just, is it going to suppress me? Like, mm-hmm. Is it going to just like quench me? And then after getting married, I kind of still had some of those beliefs going into, after being married. And so, you know, when me and my husband would go out and there were decisions to be made, I would kind of just defer to him and not really speak up for what I wanted or anything like that, because I thought that's what submission meant. And so it was a process for me of like just listening to the Lord for myself and realizing that like those things inside of me that want to come out and want I like my desires and things that I want to share and like that are different from my husband's, that I'm called to share those. And that is actually what submission means, is to submit those desires and things to my husband. And in Ephesians, it talks about like the woman or the wife submitting to the husband, and the husband's called to lay down his life for his wife. And so it's me trusting my husband enough to be like, okay, I trust that you want to lay your life down for me, and so I want to submit my desires and just all that's in my heart to you, and trust that you're going to put me first. And so I just felt like the Lord really began to show me like that that was more of what submission was just to submit all my heart and trust and trust it to my husband.
And it's really interesting because we're clearly talking about a situation not only throughout Scripture, but specifically in Ephesians 5, since you referenced it, where Christ is in the picture. So first of all, I love how before it kind of gets into the nitty gritty and it separates wives from husbands and gives them each a directive, it actually calls us to submit one to another.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that's just a posture that we should be in as believers, where we're not self-seeking. We're not trying to scramble to the top. We're not trying to be the only ones that are heard. And then there are different roles, how that plays out. I also love that God, I think this is very freeing for women, that God clearly puts the mandate on the men that as Christ loves the church and as Christ, I mean, men are completely responsible to God for any of their behavior in that sense. And so that's been very cool for me because I've been one of those people that's kind of like, is submitting for me going to be like a 12-step program? Am I going to have to clearly enter myself into some kind of therapy? Chrysanthia, give us your perspective. Where have you tread in this realm in recent years?
Well, I think I'm an older single woman, so I think my concept and my perception of submission has actually evolved from when these ladies, when I was their age versus where I am now, especially in my walk with Christ. I am positive that in my 20s, I probably just balked at the idea of submitting and not truly understanding the meaning in the scriptures and the understanding. Mm-hmm. Certainly as I've grown in Christ, I've evolved, and specifically with having one specific relationship where I was dating someone and he was clearly a spiritual leader. Hmm. And and this happened late in my 30s, and I actually welcomed that. Mm-hmm. So I've come, it's been a process for me. Mm-hmm. But I did watch my parents, my mother for the most part, model that submission behavior, for lack of a better way of saying it. Mm-hmm. And still having quite a voice, but sort of deferring to my dad for some of those major decisions. So it wasn't foreign to me based off how I grew up, but certainly as a single woman and an older single woman, I am dying to hand it over to some extent. Mm-hmm. I welcome the opportunity to fulfill my role as a wife.
Yeah.
So I'm not nervous about it at this point in my life. I think that for someone like me that is a manager, a director, a boss, sort of, I walk around with a ton of authority and a lot of burden and a lot of pressure.
Sure.
And there are times where I don't want to have to think about things. And I'm not trying to make it trivial by any stretch of the imagination, but at this point in my life, it is something that I think I even desire.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting. Do you think, have you found it in your past experience, whether in relating to men or even in dating situations, that because of where you are in your career, that they immediately associate that with, because you're like a VP, right?
I mean,
do you get guys that are just like, well, I bet she's never going to submit because she's already this, or she thinks she's, I mean, I think it's easy to stereotype.
It is very easy to stereotype, and it's also, there are a lot of assumptions that occur, and I think it's also part of the issue sometimes when someone at my age is dating. There are a number of hurdles that you have to cross, and I think there are men who are very intimidated by someone that looks like me and has education like me, and then also is in the position that I'm in.
Yeah.
So it takes a special man.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Well, let's talk a little bit, ladies, about, because I've had this question brought up a lot too, is how do we encourage men to lead in positions of, you know, if you are in a relationship. So if you're in marriage, and, you know, I want to be clear, and we've said this on the show before, that women are not called to submit to all men. So it's not like you're just the grocery store clerk and you're like, I must defer to you. I mean, it's specifically spiritual leadership and leadership within the home, specifically in marriage. So that's just a little bit of a distinction. But when it comes down, say, to like dating relationships, I think there are a lot of women that date in a, you know, kind of an unequally yoked sense, not like a straight up unbeliever, but guys who maybe are newer believers than them, or maybe the women, you know, women seem to be like in 12 Bible studies a week, and we're all like, you know, and then guys are like, what, you know, what? I was in a Bible study in 2007 and I thought it was good. So how do you reconcile that? Because I've seen women become super judgmental about that, and all of a sudden these guys aren't good enough for them. But maybe these guys are showing Christ-likeness or leadership in another way. What do you look for? And I mean, maybe Kate, you can kick it off with your own husband. I mean, how did you reconcile that? Was he just a strong out of the gate guy, or were you kind of like, what's this guy up to?
Oh no, he's very self motivated, and like he's just a natural leader, and. But just also has a servant heart. Mm. And so,
okay, that helps.
I didn't really, not specifically with him, but I would say just to just call out the good that you see in the men, and don't, I feel like it's easier to like really, you know, put them down or like see the negative, but really, I mean, I work in an elementary school with there's a bunch of boys, and just the power of telling them what's awesome about them, and they like are called up into that, and so it's not even, I feel like it's not even really addressing the negative, but it's really just like calling out the good inside of them, and they will rise up.
That's good.
I'd say also, like, I was actually talking to one of the ladies at my church about this earlier today, and she was talking about not being nagging or overbearing. And she talked about 1 Peter 3, which says, likewise, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. And then a few verses later, it says, for this is how the holy woman who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And just like the idea that, like, we don't necessarily need to be telling them what to do, or like pushing and pushing and pushing, but but just living out love and praying for them, and letting, trusting God to do the work in their heart, and not like forcing our own agenda on them.
Okay. Yeah, I guess in my late 20s, I dated someone who had, was just moving back to the church. He had sort of stepped away from the church for a number of years, and but his mother was still extremely prayerful that he was going to come back, and he did, and some of that happened because we met, and I for the most part said, you know, I'm not dating anyone that isn't part of church, who isn't in community, and he came back to the church, and I just remember one conversation I had with her, simply saying, you know, I thank you for sort of helping to facilitate him coming back to the Lord, and I mean, in his heart of hearts, he knew, I mean, he was a believer, but he just wasn't, it wasn't in practice, I guess. So it took someone like me to come and walk alongside him. I wouldn't say lead him, but because the minute he returned, he sort of stepped into a very spiritual leadership role.
Yeah. That's so interesting you say that, because I like the way that you said, you know, you were very clear about saying, you know, I will not date someone who, you know, isn't committed to the Lord, and how really it is that kind of setting apart and that challenge that does call guys up, because I know so many women who are like, okay, well, I'm just going to date him and we'll see what happens. And hopefully, you know, he's going to come to church with me. Well, then there's no distinction and it just confuses mm-hmm. whether it's men or women who are, you know, spiritually, whether they've fallen away from the Lord or they have a you know, Christian background, but don't, you know, it's really being able to say, this is what I believe. This is why this is a priority in my life. This is why, you know, to be equally yoked is a, you know, is a number one here. I think that's so helpful for, I found more people who've come back to the Lord just by like, she wouldn't date me, you know, she wouldn't, you know, and I had to start asking myself some questions, you know, about that. I think that is so good. And again, our conduct and our attitudes and what that, you know, how that brings, brings it into play. So whether in marriage or anticipating marriage, what are some of the other things that you just see as when the rubber hits the road, either personal challenges for you or things, maybe it's things where, like Cynthia said, I'm just willing to relinquish this. What are some great encouragements that we could give for guys who are kind of looking towards that role, but maybe feeling because of a culture that has kind of oppressed them or, you know, tried to feminize them and any number of things? What could we do even in stating our own fears and anticipations? Help them kind of in that direction.
Well, I know in my case, the one thing that I did was I said, you know, I'd really love for us to study the word together, to pray together. Mm-hmm. So it sort of gave him an opportunity to step up and lead mm-hmm. in that way. Mm-hmm. And even in a later relationship that I had, we had different types of jobs that bothered him, I know, but he felt really comfortable at being a spiritual leader, and mm-hmm. I could really encourage that. Mm-hmm. And I, again, welcomed that. Mm-hmm. And it was where he honestly was the most comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just trying to figure out their desire of the heart, mm-hmm. as well as because in all cases there was a desire there. There may have been some fear, mm-hmm. but just being able to communicate that you're there with them, mm-hmm. you welcome the leadership, and to walk alongside them.
Yeah.
And I think fulfilling our role, too, encourages them to fulfill their role. Like, if we're worried about obeying what God has called us to do and submitting to them, then I think they'll be more apt to actually leading. Mm-hmm. Like, I was thinking about where the root of why submission is so hard came from. Mm-hmm. And I think it started in the garden in Genesis 3:16, yeah. where she yeah. said, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole temptation of our entire gender race for as long as humanity's been in existence to fight against that and mm-hmm. to want to rule over the men. And so I think mm-hmm. if we fight our own temptations and mm-hmm. if we're battling ourselves, yes. mm-hmm. then they're more apt to be able to fulfill their roles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead. Let's just finish up then by also giving encouragement to the women, because I want to circle mm-hmm. back on this whole idea of, is submission and even marriage itself suffocating, or are you going to lose your identity? I mean, I have friends who, it wasn't even as much marriage, but when they had kids and leaving their careers, they're like, I got so much affirmation in my career. I was able to achieve. I was able to be noticed. And now my kids, they're not doing anything
no,
except taking. Exactly. I mean, have you wrestled with this idea? And in what way, how, and how can we encourage women to be like, you can still honor God, use your giftings, be who you are, not lose your personality within this. What, you know, help us pin down some of those fears and then give some hope for how we can live within that.
Yeah. I just think that we must be rooted and grounded in our identity in Christ. And like, it doesn't really matter whether we're married, if we have kids, if we don't, if we're widowed, whatever, like mm-hmm. our identity comes from him. And so just being so rooted in mm-hmm. that we're a daughter of the King, that we're loved by him, that, you know, just mm-hmm. all the things that he tells us we are, and really getting our life from him and not even from, you know, if you're mm-hmm. married, not, I don't get my life from my husband. And mm-hmm. so I just, yeah. Just, I would just encourage everyone to just go deep in their identity in God and let him tell you who you are.
Good.
You know, this one, I guess encouraging other women is actually a little difficult just because I have girlfriends who are married and who are Christians and who are raising kids but seem to be very grounded in who they are and what their relationship is like with their husbands. I mean, obviously things crop up here and there, but generally I think they feel very comfortable with submitting and the relationship that they have. So yeah, that's sort of my audience. I mean, that's my that's my circle of friends.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking very often to women who, I mean, they could, and we're just not talking about it. But I'm not talking to folks that are having or thinking this. They've been, I've got friends that have been married 20 years, over 20 years. So I want to be them. I want to be like them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I would go back to something Kate said at the beginning about like being willing and available to share your heart and your desires with your spouse and just realizing that God gave you insight and wisdom and it's not bad to open up your heart. And it's kind of the same thing with submitting to God. Like we tell him our desires and we ask him for things and we share our hearts with him, but he ultimately makes the end decision. And so just realizing that like you can still fully be yourself and share your heart. Yeah. And that doesn't take away from anything. It just means that you don't have the end, ultimate authority.
Yeah. It's interesting because it reminds me of, and I think this for me has been very freeing, the power that I have on the front end in choosing a future spouse for this. Because again, I want to date and marry someone who is the first in the relationship to bring up spiritual things, the first to volunteer prayer and to ask for prayer and to recognize his need for accountability and mentorship and whatever. And if we're paying attention to those things rather than how he dresses and how awesome he is and what his hobbies are and, you know, all this other stuff, how much money he makes, I think that's going to set us up for success down the road. I find a lot of women who are completely blind going into marriage and have just put wrong priorities there, and then they're backpedaling saying, I can't, you know, I either can't submit to this guy or he's a jerk or he, you know, whatever. And I think God is so gracious in disciplining his sons and in training up men. And if we just have eyes to see for the ones that are there who are truly following after him, I think then we'll see the ladies that Chrysinthia is talking about who are comfortable in their own skin. They know they're kept by the Lord. Like Kate said, they know that they're loved and they can move forward confidently. So, ladies, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you. This is always such a
great opportunity to just kind of break a few things down and give some folks hope and some things to think about. So thanks for being part of this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hope is arising. Beyond the known, it smooths a voyage and guides me safely home. So I'm setting sail, and I pray I'm not alone.
Well, folks, we are here for our culture segment, and I am extremely pleased to welcome back our friend, Dr. Dan Allender. He is the author of everything from The Healing Path to The Wounded Heart from back in the day, and then co-author with his friend Tremper Longman of a number of books, including Intimate Allies, The Cry of the Soul, and more. He is one of the founders of what is now known as the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, currently teaches there and speaks speaks all over the world as a Christian counselor, a PhD in that, but specifically focusing and specializing in issues of sexual abuse. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because he now has out, I think it's like 25 years later, 20, 25 years later, after The Wounded Heart, the book Healing the Wounded Heart, which is definitely chock full of new information related to this topic. So, Dan, welcome to The Boundless Show.
Lisa, thank you. And hearing all that, I actually feel rather old and tired.
Well, well, you should be, because honestly, I mean, what in the world haven't you done here? I'm telling you. I mean, you've got a lot of experience. I don't even know if you could estimate how many people you've counseled in your professional career. Thousands, probably.
Oh, it's many, but far more. It's just that sense of privilege that I really have had that opportunity to walk with many people on this. I mean, a topic that most people go, oh, I don't want to listen to that. It's just too sad or too hard. But as we began even before we started, there's such hope that in one sense to say something that almost sounds wrong, but there can be not only goodness, but a sense of joy in being able to see change in this area.
Yeah. Well, and what's so wild, I mean, not only are you speaking as a professional in this field, but you too were a victim of sexual abuse. And I remember hearing in your story, you telling a friend who was kind of confronting you on this, trying to challenge you on this, you know, basically you were in a state of denial about it, really saying, oh, well, that happened, but that wasn't abuse. And it's interesting because I have had many conversations with friends that have processed in the same way and finally like are telling me, you know, walking through their story. And they said to me, you know, Lisa, I think I finally realized it was abuse. And it makes me realize how in this hypersexualized culture with all lines being blurred, are really folks having to ask questions of themselves and say, I mean, to me, it seems so black and white. It's like, do you not know what sexual abuse is? Do you not? I mean, it's just a weird, the conversations I have with folks wondering, you know, I mean, are these repressed memories? Are they minimalizing things? Where is all that coming from?
Well, in one sense, you can say I'm much clearer about your life and story than I am mine. Hmm. So when we begin to deal with our own story, there is such a propensity to minimize or mitigate the experience. And especially in an era where we've actually seen childhood sexual abuse decrease, that's what the data would imply by a number of studies, that we've seen perhaps about a 20% drop over the last 30 years in the number of cases of abuse. On the other hand, what we've seen is a greater rise of sexual harassment with 12 to 18-year-olds to a point where 89% would say by the time they graduate that they had been sexually harassed to a point that it impeded their education, to a point where we can say in a hookup culture where 60% of the time alcohol is involved in sexual activity, that there is a loss of the ability to make even immoral choices. Choices of any sort are to some degree lessened because of the use of alcohol or drugs. And what I'm saying very quickly is we're actually seeing a rise in abuse between the ages of 13 and 22 that we can actually look at and say there has been a violation, there's been trauma, there's been abuse, and yet because people are older than they were in the normal period where abuse occurred, there's even less capacity to actually name that event as sexually abusive. So in some sense, the kingdom of evil has made it harder for people to own that this sexual event violated your own heart, mind, and body and needs to be called abuse.
Yeah. Well, and like you're saying, it's just so subversive in the sense of both sexes are being blamed, men because of the pervasive nature of pornography, women because we're playing into sexting and all kinds of, you know, basically just putting our bodies out there for sale in any level. And again, we're talking high schoolers, junior hires here even, who aren't looking at clear lines on this front. I'm curious, you know, again, getting back to stories I've heard and conversations I've had with friends who maybe eventually come to that point where they're like, okay, so there was some sexual abuse in my past. Maybe I didn't name it. Maybe it was just straight up, literally, like it was a family member, a family friend. They know they were abused. But I hear so many people say, okay, but what I need to do is I need to just forget about it. I don't want to do counseling because the last thing I want to do is dredge up all that again. That's not going to be helpful. I've forgotten most of it. And so surely can't I just move on with my life? What is problematic about that?
Well, I recently had sinus surgery because I was having repeated sinus infections. And I won't go into the gruesome details, but let's just say they had to dredge up a lot of scum that mm-hmm. had built up in my sinus cavities that wasn't getting better. Every time I got an infection, it triggered this deeper level of bacteria that actually set me into a spiral of being ill for months on a time. Now, again, it's a metaphor, but let's just say mm-hmm. there's a basic principle that we know, and that is if you won't name what is true, then your heart is not open to the kind of work of freedom, of just facing the power of shame. So that really seems to be the key issue, even back to the question that you asked before. Why do we always want to either mitigate, minimize, or absolutely deny, or just get on? Because shame is a kind of bacterial infection that literally makes us feel, to some degree, like we're going to die. Mm-hmm. And if we have the courage and honor to begin to look, turn our face, to name what not only occurred, but what the effect has been residually over weeks, months, and years in terms of what the thief has done to steal our innocence and what the killer has done to harm our hope, and in some ways what the one who wants to mar us through shame has done to bring accusations and judgments against us. This is really a spiritual war, bottom mm-hmm. line. And do you think you're going to overcome the enemy by pretending the enemy isn't there? Well, our task in facing the past is to affect what's happening today and what's happening tomorrow.
Hmm. Okay. So speaking of the past and moving into today, you were very clear about saying that this healing the wounded heart, you are writing for your grandkids in prayer for them and their sexual health and their really their understanding of God's, you know, care for them, love for their souls, love for their bodies. What would you say are the shift, or is the shift in attitudes or applications in the last 20, 25 years since you wrote The Wounded Heart that really you feel needs to come to the forefront in addressing this in today's culture?
Well, I love that word that you use, the verb blurred. There are blurred distinctions, mm-hmm. male, female, blurred distinctions with regard to what is honorable and good. So already we know this topic is one in which people either want to fight over it or flee from it, and therefore it becomes highly reactive. It's hard to have a discussion about sexuality that allows a person that opportunity to ponder and reflect, how have I come to be the man, woman, the sexual being that I am? So just trying to lower all the rhetoric on the sides of the left and the right, and frankly in the middle, you do have the silent majority. So when we begin to say, let's open up the door that we're all broken, mm-hmm. we've all been harmed in some form, and we've all done harm in some form, let's begin with a framework of Jesus knows our past, and he delights in us. He knows our present, and he delights in us. And he knows our future, and he delights in us. We can't sever our relationship with him on the basis of our sin. So if we begin with a grace-filled beginning, then we've at least got some probability of being able to enter this discussion with our hearts open to grieving and struggling with what needs to be faced for our heart to begin to invite him in to heal those parts of our heart that still feel very broken and shattered by experiences that we can cover over. But back to that horrible sinus metaphor, it's going to get triggered again. Mm-hmm. Don't think it goes away because you feel well. The next major so-called illness, it's going to trigger it again, and you're going to get sicker. So there comes a point where somebody just says, I have got to face this, and now how will I do so? And certainly the book that I've written, the workbook along with it, any author hopes that it will be a window to see what the path ahead is meant to be. But I'd also underline that this is an issue where shame silenced you, usually isolated you, and therefore it's going to have to be eventually engaged in some kind of community, mm-hmm. be it a small group, be it an individual therapist, but you have to allow these stories to be engaged with someone who's got at least the capacity to see what the journey ahead is going to require.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit, the role of Christian community in this, because I don't know of many small groups that I've been in where someone says, you know, hey, well, I know we're studying Romans, but can I just throw out there a little bit about my past sexual abuse? You know, it just doesn't come up. And so what for a caring Christian community, especially when you're in one that truly is accountable with people who love the Lord and love each other, how can believers notice, recognize, call out sexual abuse in others in a compassionate way, a truthful way, and what can we do to enter into that with others?
Well, indeed, if we're studying the book of Romans, which, like all of Paul's epistles, eventually addresses sexuality because it was such a common core issue for all humanity, but particularly in the age that he was writing, let's just say I don't want a person to bring that up in a group studying Romans with the thought now what we're going to do is talk about the abuse in your life.
Yeah.
But there should be a sense in which, first of all, it's not inappropriate to be able to say, this is how my life is refracting with, against, or in the reading of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, there has to be a context to be able to say, thank you. Thank you for that level of honesty. And though right now we can't enter the parameters of your story, we want to come alongside of you to be able to pray for you, but also one or two of us who have that story in our own life would love to sit with you, have coffee, talk more, and allow, in one sense, the extension of the group into the proper context of some level of privacy and honor to take the story to the next level. And that's where part of the plan for the workbook is. Look, even if you don't know that much about abuse, we can help guide you into the kind of conversations that need to occur to disclose, but also to pray and to be part of the process of redemption. Now, will that be the only thing you need? One person, two people? No, it's iterative and then reiterative, because what we've learned about trauma is that one telling of the story is not only not enough, but often will only sort of stir things and then bring sort of more shame. You've got to have a sense of, I don't eat one green bean and think that I've now chosen a healthy path.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to begin to change how I engage that story with a number of others in order to be in the process of seeing something of the work of God in our past, in our present, and therefore for our future.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so we have, Dan, you know, literally thousands of people listening who are in the process of dating and preparing for marriage. I think a lot of people here fall in one of two camps when it comes to addressing their sexual past. And it's either, okay, well, I'm not going to worry about this because a lifelong committed marriage relationship is going to give me the healing and security I need. So this is just going to be okay. It's going to fix everything. Or the opposite end of, I will never ever be ready for marriage, because unless I have all my ducks in a row and am completely quote unquote fixed and quote unquote whole and whatever, I can't be married. What does the person, the young adult who has a vision for marriage, wants that for their future, but is struggling with the brokenness, what steps do they need to take? What hope is there for them for moving into a godly, healthy marriage in light of a broken past?
Well, I would begin with our whole thought of what it means to be sanctified. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that you're going to be growing in Jesus on your deathbed? if you think you're going to live to the ripe age of 85, 90 and not still struggle with your own brokenness, even in those moments? So redemption has occurred, but our working toward being ultimately glorified with Jesus is a lifelong process that doesn't fully finish until we see him as he is, 1 John 3 tells us. So the first thought is, if you think you've got to have it all resolved before you get married, then you've given up marriage, you've given up life, you've mm-hmm. given up a good theology. But on the other hand, the person who's either naive or defensive or some combination of the two, who ultimately says, I don't want to deal with that because all the healing will come when I'm in an honorable, righteous, God-honoring relationship. Part of me says, yeah, great change can occur, but did you think that the strings that hold you today and bind you are just going to be somehow cut in a ceremony, and so that you are unbonded to those issues of shame? No, shame actually intensifies often in marriage. Therefore, we have to have the courage to face it today, because it's going to get harder in the context of marriage. And yet marriage is also the frame for shame to be addressed, so that when you have that last beautiful sentence at the end of Genesis 2, and they were naked and knew no shame, you enter into Genesis 3, where you now understand blaming and hiding are all a result of the presence of shame. So our task in marriage, let alone any other portion of life, is to have the courage to come to name what evil has used to bring about that marring of our beauty, that shattering of our hope, and in many ways, the loss of our innocence. All that is the work of redemption for us to become who we were meant to be.
Okay. And then just again, staying on the dating topic, a practical question here, because we get this a lot at Boundless. When is a good time or the best time or just some direction on when to talk about an abusive past in a dating relationship? Because I've heard people try to throw it out on the first coffee date, and that's super weird. And then other people never want to address it.
Well, you picked the extremes. Let's say if it happens.
I'm so extreme. I'm always extreme.
Yeah. At the first coffee date, I just, bang your head.
I've been on that date where that person put it on the table. I'm like, I don't even know where you were born, and why are you bringing that up? Yeah.
Exactly. You just want to say, look, there's no indication that you've honored your own heartache and story to divulge that at that level of almost the first hour of being together. Mm-hmm. No, that's something that comes into a naming after the relationship has begun to, shall we say, go beyond a acquaintance or early dating period. Mm-hmm. And actually, I would say even beyond that, into there's a regular level of care and commitment that's growing. I would say if that stage one just early play of dating, seeing one another. Stage two, kind of there's a new level of, there's a kind of priority to one another. As you move into where is this relationship going to go, given that there is something already clearly here, I think there is something along the lines of being able to say, you know, I've got some real brokenness in my past that still has a lot to be addressed in the present, which includes some significant sexual harm in my life. Now, that's not divulging the person, the time, the context, the story. That's simply a statement of, I want you to know there's more ahead we need to be able to engage. But is there a level of honor, of willingness to engage, not dismissive or not pressing to find out? So there is a kind of disclosure over a season that allows you, the one who's been harmed, to open the door to invite the other, not to, as a test to see whether you handle my life well, but far more, will you join me in grief? Will you join me in anger? Will you join me in my heart search for even more goodness for me and for others? If so, then indeed there will be an ongoing disclosure that doesn't finish when you get married, because the story will evolve itself as your sexuality comes to be seen more clearly, to still be somewhat harmed by some of the realities of the past.
Okay. Well, I can't even believe it. This chat has gone way too fast. Really quick as we wrap up, though, there are probably people here who now are like, okay, I clearly have something that has gone unaddressed here. I need to probably ask some questions. I might need to go talk to someone. As someone goes to talk to, say it's a professional Christian counselor, whether it's a pastor or whatever, can you just throw out a couple tips, Dan, for what they need to ask or what they need to know that the person that they're going to enter this story with is legit? I mean, what, because I've had friends with experiences, you know, going to counseling and they're like, I'm not even sure what I just heard. I'm not even sure that that person was biblical in their advice. What are hallmarks of someone who truly will be able to enter into this with you professionally?
Well, and again, forgive me for being so sinus surgery oriented, but I asked the physician, how many sinus surgeries have you done?
No, okay.
Are there ways of talking about things about, you know, cure and goodness and harm, and you know, you just need to ask questions. How often have you worked specifically with the issues of sexual abuse? Can you tell me how you view the spiritual elements of abuse? Do you actually believe in spiritual warfare? Do you have categories for thinking about narrative in our past? Where do you operate with a sense of how do you deal with shame? I mean, these are just questions any therapist ought to be able to answer comfortably, even if it's almost impossible to answer in each and every case. You ought to know where I'm coming from. How do you understand, and this may sound crazy, but how do you understand the story of Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension related to the work you're doing with me with regard to my own past, present, and future? So those are questions that many therapists might literally be stumped by. Like, I don't know, I haven't thought that through, but I'm open to helping you think that through. I want to find somebody who's familiar with abuse, who's done lots of work in that area, who has a great love of Jesus, a great love of Scripture, aware of warfare, and also highly attuned to our field and the work that needs to be done to help people grow. So let's just say that narrows a lot of therapists down to but a few.
Yeah, that's some great direction. All right, folks, I've been talking to Dr. Dan Allender. Again, the book is Healing the Wounded Heart, The Heartache of Sexual Abuse, and The Hope of Transformation. We're going to be linking to it here on the blog, so hop over there. You can check it out. Obviously, pass this on, this interview on to your friends as well. Dan, thank you so much for your time, for giving us this space, and really your expertise and your heart for the Lord and for people in their healing.
Thank you, Lisa. Privileged to be with you.
Oh, follow me.
Follow me.
Oh, follow me.
Follow me.
I can't seem to turn my heart of stone. Now I'm free from what you say, 'cause I'm going my own way. Freedom ain't so free when you're alone. Now I'm free from what you say, 'cause I'm going my own way. Freedom ain't so free when you're alone. It's been about 40 miles since I last turned around. It's been equally long since anyone could hear the sound when my heart breaks. But with every step I take, I learn a little more just where I belong. I wish the one whom I love had come along.
I thought that this would set me free, but I was wrong.
All right, folks. Well, we are finishing out the show. We have Dr. Greg Smalley here. Hey, Greg.
Great to be here, as always.
All right. Well, thanks for weighing in on this. We find you to be our go-to marriage expert, so this one is going to be no exception. You're going to have to give some good advice here because I don't have it.
I will try. Is it the fact that my office is like 5 steps from yours?
Well, that too. So. You were accessible.
So. I was bored.
So we did bring you in. That was a factor. But hey, let's be honest. All right, folks. Here's a question. And Greg's going to weigh in. My fiance and I are to be married in December. He's been married before. And I'm feeling somewhat awkward about our wedding night. Fully understand what we're not to be doing before marriage. And we made an agreement early on in our relationship to save sex for marriage. I know the honeymoon's all about practicing intimacy, which is all well and good, but what is a first-time bride to do with a second-time husband?
Yeah, you know, this would be a very similar issue that a lot of couples are dealing with, even those who had sex before marriage.
Yeah,
so not just
being married.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, honestly, I mean, this I dealt with this in my relationship with my wife Erin. So walking into our marriage, I had not waited, mm-hmm. and this is something that she and I really had to talk about. So, I tell you now, looking back, even in my own experience, I'd say first and foremost, make this a conversation to where you be really, really honest and just talk about your fears. Talk about, you know, your fear of not being the first, being compared to, not measuring up, maybe, you know, the certain performance issues. Are you going to be thinking about her? You know, just the more you can be honest, one, it takes the power away. Mm-hmm. And it makes this less scary, but what it does is it sets up a great pattern in this relationship, which is, you know, we're going to talk about difficult things. We're going to talk about our sexual relationship. So what's important is talk these things through and just be honest. Say, here's some of my fears. Hopefully he'll handle your heart by not having to say, well, here, let me tell you why that's not true, or I won't be doing that. Mm-hmm. And just say, he'll listen and validate that and just go, you know, that matters to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a reality. Because I would say she also needs to make peace with the fact that she is second. Mm-hmm. You know, she can't be first. She won't be first.
Yeah.
Even if it was, you know, for whatever the reasons his first marriage ended. I mean, that's not the issue. The fact is that she is second. Grieve that. I mean, that's a loss. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Share that with them. That's just hard and I'm struggling through a little bit of that. But I think that what she can strive to really see it as that she can be exclusive though in his heart. Mm-hmm. So she won't be his first, but she can be exclusive in his heart. I would then spend time as a couple really making this a matter of prayer. Mm-hmm. Just you know, you think of like a Psalms 55:22, you know, cast your burdens on the Lord and he will sustain. I mean, mm-hmm. making this an issue where they're coming together as a couple before the Lord and just saying, God, here's our prayer, mm-hmm. that these thoughts are taken away, that whatever, you know, I mean, that yeah. just the things that she shares as far as fears and even his fears, that they can really make that a matter of prayer. I would then do something though very tangible, and I would encourage them in a very private place to have their own foot washing ceremony. Mm. That's a sign of purifying something. And what they could do is, I mean, you think about all the issues from pornography to sexual abuse in the past to past sexual experiences to current lustful thought. I mean, mm-hmm. any of that. Mm-hmm. Just go before one another, wash each other's feet, and just say, we want that stuff, God, remove far from our relationship. There's something when you do something tangible like that, that can also have a real benefit as far as healing. I would encourage them to now give their sexual relationship just time. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is not going to be perfect. And if she walks into her marriage going, because he was married, well, I've got to be this perfect lover and I've got to have all this figured out. Come mm-hmm. on.
Yeah.
That'll come, because the cool part is that they will figure out what their unique sexual relationship is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And even the fact that, you know, that she's different than his former wife, as far as just what will feel good to her and just all that, they have an opportunity to now build something very different, which will make a difference after time. And so I think as long as they keep talking mm-hmm. and just relax, they do something out ceremonial mm-hmm. to really to wash these things mm-hmm. from out from under their relationship, make this a matter of prayer. Yeah. I think that they can walk through this and actually have a great sexual relationship.
Yeah. I would think it would also be a great area to go into, like a foray into in premarital counseling.
Oh, definitely.
If they want to bring a pastor or a counselor or just someone who can kind of help weigh in on that and assuage any fears and kind of speak to both
of
them. It could be helpful.
Yeah. And look for a mentor. I'd seek out a couple who they know and could trust within their church who's been married now for the second time and who's gone through this.
Sure.
And you know, focus on the family. We have a great article on remarried sex. Mm. I mean, so there's good information out there, but talking to another couple who've walked this road, it doesn't even have to be someone who was married before, but just like Aaron and I. Mm-hmm. I mean, I brought in the fact that I was not a virgin and we had to work through that. So I think that there's some good people who could walk with them and provide some great advice.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, folks, that's it. There you go. There's some advice there, and you can also get more advice over at boundless.org. Do share the show with your friends and send in your questions as they're available. Also, when you get the chance, hop over to iTunes and leave us a review. That always helps drive traffic to the show itself. You can subscribe to the show there, and that way you'll have it right in your inbox each week. So until then, we will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.